This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. David Gawanter is here with a new book, For Necessity, and he'll give us a poem from this book right now.
The Coin Purse. She said, "I always talk against my chances, paint a picture of what I want, and show the ways I won't get it. I fill up a room of desires, tally all the pieces there, and then, like the moving man, carry out the cargo. Such freedom. When it's empty, that is, when I see my listeners' eyes drop, finding the room cleaned out, the dusty air and echoing voice, then I click the conversation off, snap it like a little coin purse. Mm-hmm. I hoard my luck."
David Gawanter's here, and we are the ones with the luck today. Fort Necessity is the title. Does that signify what the book's about?
I hope so. It's a little bit about the structures we make to do necessary work. And it is also a reference to Colonel George Washington's hastily built fort outside of what's now Pittsburgh, Fort Necessity, which is a National Park Service site. And he was battling against the French as he was opening up the road for paying settlers for a commercial company.
So this book actually is based in history. There's a lot of personal poems in there. At the heart of each poem, there's always an individual. There's always a human dilemma. There's always a human crisis. Hmm. But most of this book is historical, mm-hmm. and we will find that out as we go along. But give us another taste of it before we get into it.
Okay, this is a poem on about Carrie Strug, the Olympic gymnast who badly injured her Achilles tendon when doing jumps on the horse. And this is the 1996 Olympics, and it was a rather kind of famous moment as she's carried off the platform after her jump. So the book is partly about what work we do and what work does to our bodies. We grind wheels and the wheels grind us. And so this is a bit about the things we do to perform and what we force girls to do for our entertainment. It's called Stick the Landing. Gymnast Carrie Strug, Olympics, 1996. Because they are tiny and gaunt and strong, willow spine and sturdy cabled legs, because they are willful and drive themselves like sled dogs, the girls grow in the gym on spongy mats and liniment air, stalking the bars and beams and horses. High above, a boy hangs from the rings, a pocket Hercules, arms rigidly out, face of stone, a kind of machine-still crucifix. Yet the muscles tremble slightly, human and imperfect, the judges note, his body on trial. The girls are pixies, though their hands blister, and live inside a Peter Pan curse, are never grown-up darlings, waving brightly in tracksuits, fresh, unstained, no blood on the leg to announce the woman in the body that clutched the last month of girlhood for years. In the stands loom their sisters, a haunt-eyed race of elves, waiting their turn, picking at calluses, little Sandy, Chantel, Becca, eager snapping birds. And the massive, soft-bellied parents who slosh and jig at their bony, capering daughters below, their rocket jumps, arched back in peekaboo, now puppet, now python, now scissors or yo-yo. Yet, all the while, the minute failings of a hand or knee dropped the score from the crevice of 10. The judges tap, tap, because they had leapt, because they coach, because girlhoods linger in their eyes, they sit there, girdled, the weird sisters. Yet their masks did crackle once and betray a feeling, just once, in Atlanta, when Carrie, the littlest of Americans, hurtled toward the horse, ricocheted upward, twisting and falling. Yet her body botched the landing, tore the ankle ligaments, toppling her back. Mark and stain were tallied. Hopping to the arms of her bear-like coach, who whispered in foreign accent, "One more vault, one high score, and we win." So she ran and jumped, desperate soldier, arching and spinning, and the feet stuck. But once she turned to face the judges, she lifted the torn leg like a fawn. Then it was that the judges gaped and jerked their hands to their open mouths, and saw the ruin and triumph of it all. After the numbers, after the ribbons and medals, it was their hands that said, judge this child. Judge this childhood that broke before you.
The voice of David Gaunter. This is the poet in the poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. David is a historian by birth or by undergraduate degree, and then went on to get his master's and PhD at, University of Berkeley, and then ran poetry programs at Harvard. And this intellectual history major you have is what interested me so much. I didn't know that, but it now seemed just right to write this book. And this book is about, in part, the rise of industrialism and capitalism and the corpses it left in its wake. Hmm. But there is a poem you have mentioned about your father and how it really ignited your understanding of human labor. Would you read us that poem?
Okay. This is the first poem in the title poem, which is a poem that's largely in documents, but there are some personal poems in it. And this is a kind of origin poem having to do with helping my father do an autopsy and learning from him and also being mystified.
He was a physician.
He was a pathologist. And I've written about doing autopsies with him before, but I sort of am, now that I'm ancient, I'm revisiting old issues. My first autopsy, age 10. A man walked into emergency, dropped dead. His body was a garden my father tilled, blade plowing the flesh, seeking his death. What part of his life had killed him?
Mm-hmm.
My father grasped dead arms. This is a working man. Little helper, I touched the puzzle of his hand. Ruts and scorch marks, yellow-brown nicotine nails, map of the defiant artifice, yielding from the heart's glutted tube, a black crumb my father took for death. He made me witness unspeakable injury, cut my childhood under its blank sheet.
What is there about that poem that is so pivotal for you?
Well, I guess I thought a long time about that. What happened when he grabbed the forearms and told me, I think he almost told me the kind of work he did, because I think it might have been a bricklayer, because bricklayers have very large thumbs from grabbing the bricks and kind of a large pad on the thumb.
And
he might have said something like that.
Is about labor.
It's about making things, and the thing that you make becomes separate to you, and then what happens to it, and what happens to the body that makes it.
And what happens to the country that has depended upon all these broken backs,
yes,
to build capitalism and to become the great industrial nation. And that, the way this book is very important is because history is history and poetry is poetry. And I do not know of another book of poetry that is history and is truly remains poetry. And the structure is extremely unique. We'll go into that. But for now, just set it up and take us on the journey.
Okay.
You have the moguls, the oligarchs of American history, like Carnegie and Rockefeller, and you weave them all through the story. And it is a book about conscience, your conscience.
Hmm.
Let's go on.
Okay. I mean, it's very kind of you to put it that way. And I guess I was trying to make a history without the historical narrator. I took the narrator out. And when I took the narrator out, the voices were left talking to each other. And then some of the elements was to find the right register for the voices so that they were saying the things I thought they were saying. And so I found the poems in the prose from these historical documents, memoirs, autobiographies, and menus, and catalogs. And then I put the voices just out there in fairly formal poems. So this first one is just a little triplet from Marx, which actually came from when I was studying intellectual history in college. It's called Arbeit, work. And these are the words of Karl Marx. So, the animal is one with his activity. The worker puts his life into the object. Then his life belongs to the object.
Terrific.
And I have another sonnet that I put together from Mother Jones Magazine about child labor before the child labor laws came in the early 20th century.
When you say Mother Jones magazine, we have to make it very clear. This book comes from years of research and gathering quotes, newspaper articles, talks, lectures, parts of drama. And so I think the reader needs to know that what you've done is an assemblage. So
yes.
Continue.
Okay. So yeah, it's a collage of voices, but I've tried to put it into a, I don't know, an operatic register, but a musical register for lyric poems. So this is a sonnet called Birth Racket. It's a fairly rhymed sonnet, actually. Birth Racket. Baby born for it. 12-hour workday, 7 days a week. Through the drum skin of its mother's womb, it rocks to the whir of machines. Iron rain. Swaddled in factory rags, toddling among forests of spindles, the racket echoing its natal home, till it casts off childish things at age 6 and takes its place on the line, a wage man, a snuff sniffer, on whose shoulders the factory teeters and grows. To speak of child slavery is to set everyone else working. Mill owners send their lobbyists to dandle toys before the legislature. Lawyers are sent to suckle the courts.
It wouldn't work without the craft. It wouldn't work without the craft. It's lyricism. Give us another.
This is one from interviews that Alan Lomax did. Alan Lomax, the great Library of Congress recorder, going around the South and West and recording people's songs and voices. And I have a few songs by him. This is a sonnet that I call either Job Sonnet or Job Sonnet. And it's a pretty tight quote from this man who suffered in the way I'm going to tell you. Job Sonnet. Got this way in the mines. We was pumping an old hole dry, did a record job, but they wouldn't give us no stove to dry our clothes at. At night, we take off wet clothes. Next morning, when we put 'em on, they'd be frozen. Well, a little while of that, and I couldn't turn my head. Boss said, you'll get along. 3 men died of consumption later, and if I didn't die right away, I've been dying by inches ever since. Look at these hands. His fingers were yellow, curled like chicken feet. The flesh of his arms turned into dry, pulpy wood. And I put that next to a couplet that I got out of the New York Times, 2014, about Carl Icahn, our great financier. And this is called Iconic Broken Labor Couplets. And these couplets really come out of the Times. Broken Labor Couplets. Mr. Icahn is worth more than $20 billion. But when management told PSC Metals Union it was dropping their health insurance benefits, PSC's website, our people are our greatest asset. Union members who rejected the new terms were locked out. They weren't negotiating, it was just take it or leave it, said Jeff Bryant, who has worked at the yard for 35 years.
This is a book that has humanitarian statements in every poem, but embedded.
I have a lot on workers. I have things on convict labor. I have ledgers of convict labor, forced labor, of free blacks in the South who were basically imprisoned with fines that they couldn't pay off and then put in a chain gang and treated like slaves. It went up to the 1920s. And they worked in Alabama and other places, but in Alabama they worked in the mines that were owned by the governor and his brother. So it was all a rather tidy arrangement. However, the plutocrats are also part of the system, and they are also human, and their bodies are also subject to the stress of this organized labor and slavery. And this is some portraits of Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the richest man in the world, and then he had alopecia. Alopecia is when all the hair of your body comes off, your eyebrows, your eyelashes, your head, everything. And he was greatly embarrassed by this, and the muckraking journalist Ida Tarbell wrote The History of Standard Oil and wrote exquisitely on Rockefeller's body. And so I have some parts from that. But I put it together. One thing I put it together was this speech from the movie Jaws, which I'll read, called Doll.
This is a wonderful part. Is everyone hearing this? This is from the movie Jaws. He's basing this on all kinds of popular culture, all kinds of historical facts. This is what is brilliant, okay. David.
Well, let's see. This is called Doll. The thing about a shark is he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't even seem to be living till he bites you and those black eyes roll over white. This is from Ida Tarbell. This is called His Eyes. Small and intent and steady, they are as expressionless as a wall. They see everything and reveal nothing. Not a shifty eye, not a cruel or leering one, but something vastly more to be feared. A blank eye, looking through and through things, telling nothing of what they found. Forever peering into hidden places, for money, always more money, planning in secret to wrest it even from his friends, never forgetting, never resting, never satisfied.
How much of those words were hers?
All of them.
Whoa, that is interesting. How did you find that?
I just sat and read, and one thing led to another. And I guess I was thinking a little bit, the structure of it wasn't planned, and I was looking for models, and I didn't see one. I was looking for
models. There is no such model. That is why people need to get this book. There is nothing like it.
Well,
for instance, I did find the poem about Rockefeller.
Sure, what do you want?
And the couplet says, "It's the only dream you can have to come out number one man, Death of a Salesman." Now, how you were able to isolate that remark from Death of a Salesman, did it come from a remembrance of the play?
No, I think I read it in an article, and then I sort of misremembered it, because I have it in there twice. One is to come out number one man, and the other way is to come outnumber one man.
Well, just quickly, I don't want to take away from the poetry, but I have to say this. You spent years and years researching this, and then you put it together. How many years did it take?
Well, it happened mostly in one fall.
You were on sabbatical?
I had a semester's leave, and I had no idea of how to get started, and I was feeling guilty, and I was staying at some friends' houses, and I was just sitting in an empty house. And I guess I was thinking a little bit about Ken Burns's Civil War and a little bit about the Voices and Visions thing. And I guess I was looking at just speeches and establishing some speeches of the things I knew I wanted to put in. And when I saw controversy between two things, then I knew there was a poem.
Keep going. David Galanter.
That's the part of verse that I like, controversy. So when there were two things that didn't make sense that were together, if I removed the narrator, I just had the voices having the debate.
And so give us more.
Okay, so let's carry on with the body of John D. Rockefeller, whose money, by the way, went to the University of Chicago, which published this book. So this one is, I'll read you two from Ida Tarbell. And the first one's called Corporate Head Alopecia. And the next one is called His Mouth. I'll just read them together. This is a combination of prose and poems. Corporate Head, Alopecia. The disease which swept Mr. Rockefeller's head bare of hair, stripped away even his eyelashes and eyebrows, has revealed all the strength of his great head, curious bumps and tightly drawn, dry, naked skin. His mouth. Its former mask, the full mustache, is now completely gone. Indeed, the greatest loss Mr. Rockefeller sustained when his hair went was that it revealed his mouth. It is only a slit. The lips are quite lost, as if by eternal grinding together of the teeth, teeth set on something he would have. It is at once the cruelest feature of his face, this mouth, the cruelest and most pathetic, for the hard, close-set lines slant downward at the corners, giving a look of age and sadness.
I should tell them who you are, though. After all, he teaches at Georgetown University, and are you a full? You're a full professor.
Yeah, I'm almost bursting.
Well, look, you are. You're fulfilled.
I have to watch out. Take
you
a
are
big
fulfilled.
Breath. Things could happen.
And he had, as I said, an undergraduate in intellectual history, which is very important to know. His book awards include the John C. Zacharias First Book Prize, Plowshares finalist, James Lachlan Award, American Academy of Poets, the Ambassador Book Award, English Speaking Union, U.S., and the Contemporary Poetry Review Book of the Year, for his Robert Lowell Collected Poems. And he has other awards, which we will pepper throughout the program if we have time. But back to this significant book that takes the voices of history, takes the ego of the writer out of the middle, and just lets them talk to each other.
It's nice of you to say that my ego has been taken out, I wonder. But here's one from the U.S. Department of Labor, and it's a sort of ballad. I have two that are in kind of ballad quatrains. Working the Flesh. From 1902 to 1907, the Factory Inspector, unofficial journal of the International Association of Factory Inspectors, published accounts of industrial accidents. Butler, P.A. A heavy pot of molten steel poured on two workmen, literally cooking them. Mm. Caught in a shafting, a boy working in a coffin plant was decapitated and limbs cut off. Philadelphia Carmel Works. Martin Stoffel was sliced into small pieces. Then, a curious coincidence, two men called John Minnick, unrelated, working in different cities, working the same day and hour, were each killed when their clothing was caught in rotating shafting. No one witnessed either accident. And then I've put, because I have side notes here, and I've put my own note as a kind of showing that my ego isn't completely gone. I say, but the department remembers an interesting death.
And also the assembly line moves on.
Yes.
Never stops, never misses a beat, I'm sure.
It keeps going. I have another ballad, this one I call Wear the Yellow Badge. This is Jonathan Swift's Badges for Beggars, homeless people coming into your town and what to do with them. So this is 18th century stuff. Wear the yellow badge. That the said beggars should be confined to their own parishes, that they should wear badges well sewn upon their shoulder, always visible on pain of being whipped and turned out of town, or whatever legal punishment may be thought proper and effectual. What shall we do with foreign beggars? Must they be left to starve? No, I answer, but they must be driven or whipped out of town, and let the next country parish do as they please.
Let us be clear. This is from an 18th century author verbatim, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And you massaged it into what form?
It's a ballad.
A ballad. So we have ballads, we have couplets, we have lyricism, we have all forms of poetry here. And telling a historical story. Before you read the next poem, would mm-hmm. you just read in the margins your sources?
Okay. So this next page has the title of a book by Charles Koch, and it's put as a call and response quatrain with the U.S. Senate report from 1989. Then I have The Death of the Salesman, come out number one man, as you said. Then I have witness testimony that I participated in, and D.C. Superior Court and notes I took of a case.
Let's hear it, though. These are the actual words from those sources.
So this is the call and response quatrains called Extra Extra. Good profit. How creating value for others built one of the world's most successful companies. The book by Charles Koch. Senate report. Koch Oil was engaged in a widespread and sophisticated scheme to steal crude oil from Indians. Number one, this is from Death of a Salesman. It's the only dream you can have, to come outnumber one man, to come outnumber one man. And then witness testimony that I heard. Guarding guards. This is in Terzarima, this poem. We were called in. A shoplifter was seen lifting his security guard jacket and putting meat around his torso. So we stopped him, and there was a lot of tussling and rustling. We had him down, but he slung us off one way and another, and then from his sock, pulling out a steak knife. Brother, I'll stab you up. But we got him down, blood from the steaks all over his face, and deli meats spilling on the rugs.
Was that your observation?
Yeah, I was on a grand jury.
Well, before we go further, because we are coming to our final poem, mm-hmm. what do you think the reader will understand about poetry and history by this book? What do you hope they will?
Poetry was one of the first voices of history. And the word histor also means judge, the community judge. So one of the things that a poem can do is put the raw materials of history in front of you without the beguiling narratives of the historian. Now, which voices you get and what they are having to say is certainly under arrangement, under argument, and all the rest of that. But rather having H.G. Wells's histories or someone else, a wonderful prose writer, I tried to get the people. I don't have the voices distinct from people. I'm not doing the poem that's being done nowadays, which is the poem that takes parts of language and looks at the powers of ruling language and uses poetry as a language against that language. It's a very good poem. I'm not doing that. The voices I have are identified with people. They have authority. There's not disembodied voices. The people said this. Darwin said this about America. George Washington said this when he put Fort Necessity together. Rockefeller and Carnegie said the things they said. Carnegie tried to buy the Philippines for $20 million to prevent us from going into war. So these are the actual moments of history that are put here, but they're put into a poetry register, which means that I've stripped away the excess stuff. I've stripped away the language and left the music of the language. And so that's the conversation I'm creating here in this book.
And the book is Fort Necessity. It is an important book. And not only that, it is beautiful poetry.
Oh,
may
you.
We have a final poem.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Doctor Things. And here's a prose poem about doctors who the fantasy of this poem is that doctors take on the illness of their patients. They absorb them into their bodies. And then they all go out to a little beautiful little town in Cape Cod called Wellfleet, and they sit in front of the ocean, and all the illnesses get washed out into the ocean. So this is called Wellfleet Off Season. You're shaking your head.
Only you. David, we have to do an autopsy on your brain to see how this all works.
Not yet.
Not yet. Continue.
I still need it, I think. Wellfleet Off Season. The doctors do not read the sea or the grindstone beach. Swaddled in holiday hats and sunglasses, they doze like ancient directors on the set, while salt air and neap-tide winds gently abrade the flesh until their ash of illness crumbles and drifts away, miseries given back to nature each August, motes for the crab to pick, mulch for the beach flower, until, scrubbed clean, the aged ozone babies return to their cities, ready for another year. Now, in November, the beach performs for no one, a soup of rock and water, waiting for August, washing itself absently. Exhalations rise through cold air. Clouds twist like rags, like lancets or gauze. No heroic gestures, just headless statues of mist, darkening as their bellies grow.
The voice of David Gawander. I don't know another book that has the human heart of history so beautifully rendered. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and Logan David Foundation, in additional support from the SciNipid Fund. The Poet and the Poem, Making History, now can be downloaded free of cost on iTunes. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.